Okay, so welcome everyone. I can't see you, but hopefully you can see me. Hopefully there's someone out there watching this talk. It's unusual to talk to a camera, but you know, I guess it does the same purpose. So it's good to have you there if you are there, and if you're not there, then that's okay too. Today I thought I was going to talk about one of these things that tends to be very topical at a time like this. That is death. And I quite like to talk about death. I think it is a very useful contemplation for anyone who is interested in the spiritual life, whether that spiritual life is Buddhist or whatever it is. It's a kind of a very fundamental aspect of how we, of life, and how we deal with life and the problems of life and all of these things. It is sort of the, in many ways, perhaps the biggest. And one of the biggest things in human life that kind of stands there as this, you know, this pillar, this beyond which we cannot see anything, we don't know what happens. And it kind of gives meaning to life, but it can also lead to despair and problems if you think about death in the wrong way. In these times, it is very useful to, I think, talk about this and draw out some of the lessons of Buddhism and also look at this maybe from different kinds of perspectives. Look at the world and you look at, you know, history and you look at the various, how various cultures and maybe non-cultures or anybody really anywhere, how they have dealt with death, it has always been a massive impact on people's consciousness throughout the centuries and throughout the millennia. Just a very, very brief overview of some of these ways that people have tried to deal with death. And one of the things that comes to mind straight away is the way the Vikings dealt with death. And being myself Norwegian, I'm supposed to have some Viking genes. I don't really feel that much like a Viking, but anyway, who knows? There might be some genes deep down there somewhere that have been overpowered by Buddhist genes over time. And now I've become the gentle Viking. Sounds like an oxymoron, but maybe that's the case anyway. The Vikings, the way they dealt with death, they would take their famous longboats. And of course, the Viking longboats, if you look at them, is very beautiful vessels, actually. You can see them in museums in Scandinavia to the present day. Very good sea vessels, and they could travel far, travel all the way to North America from Scandinavia in those vessels. And so they would take these longboats that were owned by the, you know, the chieftains in the Viking tribes. And when the chieftain died, they would make a massive hole in the ground, put the longboat in there, and then add a lot of the possessions of that Viking chieftain. All the things that he treasured in this life would be buried in this grave together with this chieftain. And sometimes also some of his workers and maybe some of his wives even would also be buried in the same thing. And of course the idea is that when you then go to the other world, Valhalla or whatever it is that you believe in, when you go to that other world, then you take these things with you. And that's why they get buried in the ground with you. And very cruelly, also then including some of the people in your life that were very important to you. So that's how they dealt with attachment. Because attachment is one of those things that get really challenged when you are about to die. And it's very hard to deal with that. And the idea is then you're so desperate that you bury it all in the ground so as hopefully to enable you to take that with you into your future existence. Even though you're supposed to go to Valhalla, and in Valhalla all you do is drink and fight. You then die, and as soon as you die, you kind of re-arise again, you continue drinking and fighting. What kind of heaven is that? I wonder how they could even conceive of that as a heaven. It must say a lot about the Vikings to have that kind of heaven. But even then, they were so attached to their possessions. Even though there is nothing really much about women in Valhalla, still they wanted to take their wives along. So that despite their ideas of heavenly realms, the attachment actually won out over the view they had about what heavenly realm was about. You can see just how the power of attachments in people. But it's not just the Vikings who had these ideas about death and how to take things with you into the future life. This is a very recurring theme around all cultures around the world. And for example, in India, you have a well-known tradition called the Sati tradition. And Sati is where a wife would immolate herself, burn herself up when her husband died so that she could follow her in the grave. And again, a very cruel kind of tradition. But still, it shows you this idea of wanting to take the things that are really dear to you with you into the next world, not being able to let go, trying to grasp onto this life, pulling this life with you into the next world, because you just can't deal with death. Death is such a powerful moment. We don't want to have to deal with it. We want to take everything with us. If you go to China, the Chinese tradition, if you go to the Taoist tradition, you have this idea of burning things. You burn a house, you burn a car, and then you burn a really nice car. You have like a paper version of a car. And of course, it has to be a nice one. It's maybe a Rolls Royce. In this life, you maybe only have a Beetle, but you want to upgrade a bit into your next life. So you burn a Rolls Royce. Not only do you want to take things with you, you want to upgrade, because it's kind of easy to upgrade when you move from one life to the next one. That's kind of the point, yeah? Because it's kind of a jump. Pick, you jump up. Book. Okay, now you have a Rolls Royce instead. You just stretch that Beetle a little bit and make it a bit more fancy, put in a larger engine, and then you have a Rolls Royce. Maybe. I don't know. Maybe that's possible. Not sure. But so you burn all of these things. You burn all of these treasures in this life. You burn a house. You have an ordinary house. You build something a bit larger. You burn that. You burn some paper money. You add lots of zeros on the end to make sure that's really valuable money. And then you burn it. And then in the heavenly realm, yay, you have all of these things with you. It's a bit, little bit, you can see how all of these things are a little bit desperate. They are a little bit, it's obviously, I think, I don't know if people really believed in it, or whether they were just so desperate that they kind of did it anyway, even though they didn't believe in it. Because obvious, it's fairly obvious that this is very unlikely to make any difference, whether you get buried with all your goods or you burn a paper car. Doesn't seem like very likely it's going to have an effect in the afterlife. So that is how powerful a moment death is. People are desperate to deal with it in one way or another. And this despair of dealing with the afterlife comes into the very present day as well. That's why people are so scared when it comes to the COVID-19. That's why they're scared about climate change. Maybe this is one of the reasons we are so slow in dealing with the climate catastrophe around the world, because we just don't want to face it. It is too harsh. It reminds us of our mortality. It reminds us of the problems it is to die. And so we just shut our eyes because we can't deal with it. And then the politicians know that that's how we prefer to do things. And then they don't do anything either, because they realize that we want to be blind. We don't want to see reality. Truth is too tough to deal with. And of course, if you don't deal with truth, reality becomes even worse as a consequence, because you are closing your eyes to what is going on. And sometimes I think that is the problem. We just can't deal with these big truths of the world. And it takes someone special to be able to do that. Someone like the Buddha. He knew how to deal with death. And one of the fascinating things that you have seen in the present day, one of the things that was the background for giving this talk, was some newspaper articles I read a few months ago. I can't remember now how far back it was, maybe 6 years ago, maybe something like that. And these were newspaper articles about what some of the great innovators in Silicon Valley were doing to try to cheat death. I'm talking about Silicon Valley now. I'm talking about some of the most brightest, smartest people in humanity here. They too couldn't face death. They too, it was just the same problem for them as for everyone else. These are the super bright people. And they had their own methods trying to extend life, sometimes indefinitely into the future, because they wanted to cheat death. And it was very powerful to read that, because when you see some of these names that were listed there on this article, there's some of the great kind of luminaries of Silicon Valley, again, probably some of the brightest people in the world. And yet, they were afraid of death. Yet, they were trying to cheat death in ways that obviously were not going to work. And it reminded me of the big gulf often there is between intelligence and wisdom. You can be super duper, 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 many, many dupers, many, many supers in front, intelligent, and yet it doesn't necessarily mean that you have any wisdom. It doesn't mean you don't have any wisdom either. But I think often there is no direct relationship between wisdom and intelligence. You can be a dum-dum and you can be quite wise. You can be super smart and you can lack wisdom, or vice versa. I don't think there often is any necessarily all that much correlation between the two. This is, I think, a very important point, because we tend to make very much out of intelligence in our world. We tend to kind of lift it up and make it into something very important. When someone does well at school, we think, yay, hooray, they're doing really well. And then we forget that actually what makes you function as a human being, what gives you the potential for real happiness inside, what makes you understand life for what it really is, actually is often nothing to do with whether you do well at school or not. Nothing to do with whether you become a CEO or a venture capitalist or an entrepreneur in Silicon Valley. All of that may be irrelevant. All it does, it gives you this external glory. Other people say, yeah, look at those people, they are doing really well. And it's that external praise, because we crave that external praise. That is one of the main reasons why we are so keen on intelligence. But if we really wanted to know what matters in this world, if we really understood, if we really focused on the right thing, which of course is happiness, which is meaning, living in a purposeful way, being able to deal with the problems of the world, then we would value wisdom much more. We wouldn't be so concerned whether our children did well at school or whether they were mediocre or whether even they failed. That wouldn't be the main thing. Instead, we would focus on instilling good values in them so they could deal with life in a good way. That is what really matters. And I always reminded, when Ajahn Brahm talks about his days at Cambridge University, and Cambridge University has had and still has to the present day some of the largest concentration of Nobel Prize winners in the world, very, very large numbers, and that's why they're always at top on all, one of the reasons why they're always at the top of international rankings of universities and all of this. And this was Ajahn Brahm's insight. And Ajahn Brahm was a top scholar at Cambridge University. He was one of the brightest there, in addition to having a lot of wisdom. That's kind of the astonishing thing with Ajahn Brahm. But he was there, and he realized that actually all that intelligence often doesn't do very much to you. It doesn't really help you to lead your life in a better way. It helps you to get your Nobel Prize, but it doesn't help you to be happy. What's the point of having a Nobel Prize if you're miserable? Does that Nobel Prize really make much difference? Does that make you happy? I think the answer is, it gives maybe some sense of achievement, some sense of satisfaction, but it doesn't really do anything deep. It doesn't give you that deep satisfaction, understanding how to deal with life. So this is the problem, and we need to focus more on wisdom rather than intelligence. So what was it that these people in Silicon Valley were suggesting? What was their way of dealing with death? And what they were suggesting, because they are just as petrified of death as anyone else, because of that lack of wisdom there, they had this idea: what we want to do is extend our life indefinitely. See if we can live eternally. That was the idea that they had. And then they came up with all of these schemes, and they started putting lots of money into startups that could decode, find out which genes are the ones that keep us long-lived and how we can kind of ensure that life lasts into the future. And they would investigate certain insects that seem to be immortal. Apparently there's an insect called the hydra. And if this hydra is virtually immortal, if you cut it in half, you get two hydras. If you cut it in four, you get four hydras that just grow out again. If you cut it in 100, you get 100 hydras. They all kind of just multiply, tick, 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 and they have 100 hydras. There's a tiny little thing, it's only a quarter of an inch long, but if you cut it in 100, apparently you get 100 hydras. If you apparently, if you decompose it using some kind of decomposing material, which separates every cell in the hydra into its individual cells, it's all detached, it naturally comes back together again and makes itself back into a hydra. Yeah, and then it lives on and on and on, apparently. It just goes on and on and on, and there's no sense of this hydra dying here. So this is the kind of investigation they do. Yeah, these weird animals try to find, what's the secret? Can we import some of those genes from the hydra into our own human being? Yeah. And then you may have heard of the cryogenics. Cryogenics is one of the ways, one of the ideas they have is that you freeze the body down to a temperature of minus 160 using liquid nitrogen or something like that. And you keep that body frozen in this way, in like a suspended animation, not really dead, yeah, with the potential for re-arising again in the future. So when the technology is advanced enough, that's the idea, then we will thaw that body, yeah, get it back into business, use technology to kind of make it all work, and then you can carry on, you know, 100 years into the future, or 50 years, or 200 years, or however long it takes to come up with the right technology to deal with a body that has been frozen down. It's kind of desperate, isn't it? It's kind of really over the top, this idea that you're going to kind of live forever in this way. And I must admit, when I read about this cryogenic idea, it occurred to me that, well, what if you are successful? What if the body does go into a kind of suspended animation? It doesn't really die. What does that mean from a Buddhist point of view? And what it means from a Buddhist point of view is that your consciousness is still going to be attached to that body. Yeah, if it is still alive, your consciousness is going to be there. And imagine being attached to a body which is minus 160 degrees. It's going to be a little bit cold. Yeah, it's going to be freezing. Imagine being attached to that body. And it reminded me of the one of the Vikings. They had the hell realm that was cold. Yeah, it's always like that. What you fear the most are the things that is the suffering you already have in this life. And for the Vikings, cold was suffering, because you live in Scandinavia, it snows 6 months of the year, and there's ice, and you have to make fires and everything. So for them, the hell realm was a cold one, a frozen one. And I thought, all these people in Silicon Valley who are freezing down their bodies, probably they go to that Viking hell realm. Yeah. But much worse, probably, minus 160 degrees, and your consciousness is still attached to that body, you can't get out. You have told the scientists, keep me in there until you find the thing. There's nothing you can do. You're stuck in this hell realm for who knows how long. And maybe someone will forget you in that freezer, yeah, and they kind of leave you in there for a really, really long time. And after a few thousand years, what is this stuff over here, all this liquid nitrogen or whatever, and you've been in that place for so long? I don't know. To me, that is one possibility. When you start messing with these things without really knowing what you're doing, without having a big picture of how consciousness works, and this is what they don't have, yeah, they think consciousness is somehow tied to the physical body absolutely. When you have a different view of these things, actually, it starts to look quite scary. Yeah, what they are doing, if they succeed, actually, all they may be succeeding in is going to some terrible place and having to suffer for a long time. And if they don't succeed, if consciousness does not attach to that body, well, then the whole experiment is not going to work anyway. Because when you wake that body up, it's going to be dead. There's going to be nobody there, nobody home. So either way, it seems to me to be an absolutely disastrous way of trying to cheat death. You start to wonder, what is worse? Is it maybe better to die, perhaps, rather than kind of going to this terrible state? To me, it's very obvious what the answer is. Sometimes you make something much worse out of a situation that was only a little bit bad to begin with. So this is one of the things that they have been, you know, doing. Another interesting thing they have been talking about in the Silicon Valley to, you know, this is kind of more for the future. That's why they freeze the body first, so in the future they can use this technology. Another one they've been talking about is to upload the mind to some kind of computer. Yeah, so you upload the mind into a computer, tick, bang, into the computer, and then the computer gets maybe put into the head of a robot, and then you can walk around like a robot, yeah? And then you are uploaded into this robot. something like that. So you have a mind in here uploaded to the thing, and then you kind of walk around as a robot. Does that make any sense? It's almost as if they think the mind is like software. Yeah, you just extract the software, tick, okay, put in a USB stick, bang. You have to have a really big one because the mind is many, many gigabytes, many terabytes probably. How many bytes is the mind? Does anyone know? A lot of bytes, yes, a lot of bytes in there. So you have to have a very large memory stick. Probably hasn't been invented yet. That's probably one of the things they're waiting for, the memory stick becoming large enough. And then put a kind of USB port in the side of your head. Click, put the memory stick in, and you download the mind. Bing, and it goes into a computer as if it is software. Yeah. But, I think they have misunderstood how the mind works. You cannot download the mind in that way. The mind is not like software within the brain. The mind is a thing which is behind everything else. The mind is what matters. It's not really downloadable. It's not a physical entity. It's not electrons. It's not a current. Yeah, it is beyond the ordinary kind of ways of looking at the world. That's why you can't really measure the mind in any ordinary way. So it's just a fantasy. But it shows you how desperate they are to live forever. And anyway, even if you were able to get your mind somehow into a computer, maybe it can be done, but not in that way, then would that really be worthwhile? And then you keep on upgrading that computer, that robot, again and again and again, in the pursuit of living forever? Is it a good idea to live forever? Is it a good idea even to live for a million years? This pursuit of immortality, is that even wise to begin with? Does it make any sense? There is another way they try to do this before I answer that question, and that is called transhumanism, something like that. And the idea is where you gradually exchange parts of the body. You cut them off, or when they stop working, you put in new parts, yeah? So you use titanium or you use whatever, and gradually you kind of turn into a robot, and it's less and less left of your organic self. And eventually there might be nothing left at all, yeah? Can that be done? Maybe. I don't know. I have no idea. But again, it is this quest for immortality, yeah? For living forever, or at the very least, to live for very, very long periods of time. To my mind, the whole idea of living forever is so fundamentally flawed. You know, you haven't really thought things out properly if you think that living forever is a good idea. What does it mean to live forever? And if you imagine yourself, especially here in the human realm, you can somehow live for, even if it's not forever, even if just a few million years, but forever makes it far worse, then what would it be like? Well, what it would be like in the human realm, it would mean that you are here carrying on while everyone around you, the whole world is always changing. Everyone is always dying. Yeah, after a million years you have been married, let's say an average marriage lasts for 50 years. So a million years, that is how many? That's about 20,000 marriages. Imagine having been married 20,000 times. And every time you get attached to the person, every time you have to grieve, after a while, it must be terrible. It must be absolutely exhausting to having to go through that and knowing that every time you do it, the world around you is going to change. There's nothing you can hold on to. There's nothing there which really is you can carry with you. You can't attach anymore. But you have to attach. You need to attach because that is so deeply ingrained in you. All you have is the suffering of change. All you have is the problem of the world always changing. So you can see here how it hasn't really been thought out properly. The idea of living forever is like a nightmare. It's a scenario where you are there, but nothing you can hold on to. Everything is always changing. All you're doing, you're desperately trying to hold on to things that can never be held on to. And at the end of the, I think after a while, you would just yearn to die. You would yearn to get out of here because you had enough of all of this. All you want to do is cease and come to an end because it is so painful to live in the world where there's no control and there's a so endless amount of problems. So the idea of eternal life is kind of crazy. Yeah, it's just mad. If you think about it, this is very similar to the way we talk about death in Buddhism. Yeah, the only difference is that in Buddhism you get reborn. Yeah, and one of the things about rebirth, of course, is exactly the same thing. That every time you get reborn, you have to go through the same pain of losing everything that you're attached to, everything you loved, everything that was dear to you in this life has to go again every time you are reborn. But in a sense, the mercy, if you like, or maybe not the the really bad thing about rebirth is that we cannot see it happening. On the one side, that's merciful, otherwise we've been crazy for a long time ago. On the other hand, it's a curse, because it means you cannot really see what is happening, so you keep on making the same mistake over and over again. But this idea of living on forever is very similar to the Buddhist idea of why rebirth is so unsatisfactory. Why re-death? Because re-death is implied by rebirth. Why that is also unsatisfactory? Because you have to go through the same process of suffering again and again and again, never really getting out of it, but being blinded by it. At the very least, if you live eternally, you should have some idea, some ability to see things in context. But if you just get reborn, in some ways it is even harder. But there's a very close connection there. And those people who go for that, they're going for a curse. They're going for something far worse than actually dying itself. So what is the next step? Well, the next step of the idea of eternal living is the idea that you have in many religions. In religions, commonly the idea is that you go to some eternal realm after you die. How is that different from living eternally as a human being? Well, the difference is that in these realms where you know, if it is a religion, they are only fantasies, they're not real realms from a Buddhist point of view, but eternal life in a heavenly realm, the difference is that, well, other things are also eternal, yeah? So it's not just you. Your mates are also eternal. Your family is eternal. The things around you last for a long time, or maybe they are eternal too. I don't know. I'm not sure if Ajahn Brahm always talks about the golf course in the heaven. Yeah, you know that joke about the golf course in heaven? You don't know joke about golf course in heaven? Okay. According to Ajahn Brahm, there's a golf course in heaven. You know that joke, yeah, about the husband and wife. Both of them die and they go to the heaven and then St. Peter takes them around and shows them the massive mansion and shows them all the cars and the garage and the stereo and everything is just super fancy and then shows them the golf course. Yeah? So there's golf course in heaven according to Ajahn Brahm. And then the end of after a while, this husband starts to get angry with his wife. And gets really upset with her. And the wife said, "Why are you so angry? What are you so upset about?" And eventually the husband says, "Well, if it hadn't been for all that health food that you were making for us, we would have been here a long time ago." That's the joke. And Ajahn Brahm apparently tells that joke at funeral services. Ajahn Brahm is one of the few people who tells jokes at funeral services. But he can do that. Some people have the power and the ability to get away with that sort of thing, and done actually in a very nice way. So there's a golf course in heavenly realms. Now I'm wondering, does the golf course last forever? Or is that boring? Does it have to change? Okay, we're getting into technical details. Maybe not. Don't need to go to those technical details. Things in heaven are more permanent. Yeah, so let's just assume that things are always there in the heavenly realm, but they carry on and on and on. Heaven really is supposed to be eternal, according to some religions. Yeah, so it just goes on and on and on. And one of the things that I think we don't understand sometimes, the reason why our short human life feels meaningful, purposeful, it feels like there is a reason why we're here, is precisely because it is short. We have a certain structure, there are certain things that we do, and those things we do, the goals we have, goals are only meaningful when there is time, because goals happen within a time framework. Meaning only happens within time. If you start stretching this out, it starts to become very different. And if you stretch it out to eternity, nothing can have any meaning anymore. There can be no goals anymore. Why? Because goals are always bound by time, by definition. That's what the goal is. So life is going to become utterly meaningless if you have eternity. You just carry on doing the same things again and again and again. And after a while, you're going to be so utterly bored. Yeah, there's nothing more to attain. There's no place to go. You are in heaven. Everything is already perfect. There's nothing to be done. All you're doing is playing golf every day on the same course with the same clubs, getting a perfect score every time. You can see how that is like a nightmare. You can see how that is kind of terrible when there is no purpose to existence, when there's no sense that you're going to a goal anymore. There's nothing to do. It becomes another curse. It becomes another terrible thing. And all you can think of is probably how to get out of heaven because you had enough of staying there. And that is where all you have to do is you have to change your religion and become a Buddhist. And as soon as you become a Buddhist, you get reborn, you get out of heaven again. So that's a simple solution, how to get out of heaven. Just become a Buddhist instead. Okay, maybe not. Maybe not become a Buddhist. Just accept the reality, the Buddhist idea of thinking about things, which is far more reasonable anyway, because this idea of permanence actually doesn't really hang together anyway. Again, this is the Buddhist speaking here. So, again, the idea of carrying on forever, eternal life, again, even within religion, it is like something actually quite unpleasant. And people often don't think these things through. And apparently there is a psychological condition called the fear of eternal living or the fear of eternity. Yeah, some people have this because they realize deep down that eternity actually is something terrible. It is something without meaning, without purpose. And you can't enjoy eternity. Eternity becomes something terrible after a while. But of course, you can take this further, and you can take this to say that, well, actually, eternal living doesn't mean quite that, because that kind of heavenly idea is very similar to how we live our human life. Yeah, similar kind of things, except that they go on forever. And that's not what we want to think of as eternity. Instead, we like to think of eternity more like they do in the Hindu tradition, the Advaita Vedanta, non-dual Vedanta tradition, yeah? Where, and maybe similar things perhaps also in certain parts of Christianity, or many religions have subgroups who think like this. And in those traditions, the idea is not that you kind of live eternally with your friends and your golf course or whatever, but it's more like you achieve some very sublime state of mind, a state of samadhi, a state of bliss, which is utterly unchanging, and that carrying on for eternity. Yeah, when you merge with God or with Brahma or something like that. And then of course, it starts to become a little bit more reasonable. Yeah, then we can maybe at least go part of the way with them. We can understand what they're talking about, because some of these things are similar to the things that we experience also as Buddhists through meditation practice, especially if your meditation is going really, really well. You have something like that. Of course, here, this too is problematic. This too is problematic because that too, after a while of blissing out, doesn't really cut the ice anymore. You want to go further, and that you can go further according to Buddhism. You can go even deeper in those things. But the main problem is, of course, that it is all impermanent. Yeah, it doesn't really exist. It isn't possible according to Buddhism. These states are created, and because they have come into existence through cause and conditions, by your practice of samadhi, they can only last so long. Anything which is created through cause and conditions has a sell-by date, to have a date when it's going to expire. It cannot last beyond a certain point, precisely because the conditions that support them will also fade away, and then the state itself will fade away. So that too doesn't really work. So that the result of all of that is that you have to give up on the idea of living eternally. You have to be very careful you don't fall into that trap, because such an idea is either it is a curse or it is impossible. Either way, it's something that you really don't want to do. You don't want to go there. So eternalism is out of the question. So if eternalism is out of the question, if that is not the answer to death, what might be the answer to death? Because death is still a problem. We can all agree that death doesn't work. Death is painful. Death is hard. Yeah. So we still want to seek a solution to this. So where then do we seek? And one of these other, another thing I came across a few months ago that was very interesting was this group of people who called themselves the antinatalists. Yeah, antinatalist means that they are against birth. Yeah, they're anti-birth, basically. And the reason why they're anti-birth is because they say human existence is not worth it. Human existence is so problematic that if we put a child into this world, well, we will be responsible for the suffering of that child. We don't want any child to come into this world and to have to suffer. So we are anti-birth, anti-natalist. And this apparently is a real group of people. I think you can look them up on Wikipedia even. They are there and they say, yeah, no more birth. We are anti-birth. And that actually is quite a nice idea. And it's getting very close to Buddhism. Yeah, Buddhism, we try to end rebirth. It's getting close. It's not quite there yet, but they are moving maybe more in the right direction. It is closer to Buddhism than eternalism, which really goes against all Buddhist principles of impermanence. The problem with antinatalism is that you cannot stop birth by not procreating. You can procreate. If you don't procreate, that is not what gives rise to new human beings in the world. Yeah, whether you have a child or not, that's not going to make any difference. I actually got this question a couple of years ago when I was in London. I gave a talk at the Buddhist Society in London, which was very nice. And this one person asked me there, and he said, well, is it really right to give birth to people in the present world when there's so many problems and we know that there's overpopulation anyway, we need to reduce humanity? Does it not make more sense to not have children than to have children? And I can see where he's coming from. But the point is that you cannot really stop people getting reborn by not procreating. If there are people who have the karma to get into the human realm, then they will continue anyway. They will go somewhere. They will get reborn. And even if they don't get reborn among the humans, they will get reborn somewhere else. So sometimes it's more useful to ask yourself, we cannot stop people getting reborn, because rebirth happens because of craving, not because of, procreation. And because of that, it is much better to ask, well, can I help a child to have a good life, to get good values? Can I add something to somebody else's life? And if you feel that you have something to add to somebody else's life, something to offer to the world, to make them good people, to improve their lot or whatever, then maybe having a child is not such a bad thing, because you're giving a child an opportunity to have the right values and do things in the right way. If you have doubt about your ability to raise a child in the right way, then maybe you should not have a child. But if you feel that you have some values that you can carry on and you have a lot of kindness and compassion in your heart to deal with people in the right way, then maybe you should be a parent because of that. So it is not wrong to be a parent. I'm not saying it is wrong, right to be a parent. I'm saying it's neutral. Whether you want to be a parent is entirely up to you. Certainly shouldn't be any pressure on having to have children, that kind of thing. But it is neither right nor wrong. It is how we do things in the world that matters. It is not things in themselves that are right or wrong. It is not the action that is right or wrong. It is how we do things that matters in Buddhism. So these anti-natalists, they are getting it, they are moving towards the solution. They have understood that there is a problem with birth. They just don't understand the idea of rebirth. They don't understand the real way of stopping birth. And that is where Buddhism comes in. The real way to end birth is to understand the nature of life. And then from understanding the nature of life, allow life to peter out and to come to cessation. That is the Buddhist way. You cease the future rebirth. You cease the future reproduction. Everything ceases. Everything becomes cool. And that is how the Buddhist path actually works. So both the idea of not getting reborn, which is really just a variety of annihilationism, you just end things, you want to end things, or eternalism, neither of these work. And you need the Buddhist middle path. The middle path you find, which is really called dependent origination in the suttas, that is where you want to go. So how does this tie in with Buddhist teachings even more so? And I haven't talked that much about death itself. We'll talk a little bit about death towards the end of this talk. And exactly this contrast between eternalism and between the fear and danger of death I'm talking about now, we find exactly the same teachings in Buddhism. In fact, we find it in the biography of the Buddha. We are now going into the Vaisak season. Can you see all the lights here? It's like it's a bit like Christmas, actually. Maybe Christmas and Vaisak have a lot in common, but except that it says Vaisak, so it must be Vaisak. So we are going into the Vaisak season, and of course the Vaisak season is a celebration of the life of the Buddha, his birth, his awakening, and also his passing away. The Buddha's passing away is a happy occasion in Buddhism. Yeah, yay, celebrate, the Buddha passed away. It's a bit sad for every one of us, but it's happy for the Buddha. That's kind of the problem with Vaisak. So it is the Vaisak season. So let's talk a little bit about the Buddha's life and how death kind of fits in to the Buddha's life. And it's actually quite interesting. Now, one of the things that you start to see when you start to read the early texts of Buddhism and you start to see the life of the Buddha, how it was explained by the Buddha himself, you start to get a feeling for what it is that was the motivation, the driving force in the Buddha for becoming the Buddha. I shouldn't say the Buddha, I should say the Buddha to be. What was the driving force in the Buddha to be, to become the Buddha later on? And very often, we hear in Buddhist circles that the driving force for the Buddha was compassion for all beings. The Buddha saw the suffering in the world with his powerful, the Buddha to be saw the suffering in the world with his powerful faculties. And then he decided that I need to do something about this. And that was the motivation for the Buddha to be, to set out on his quest and then eventually become the Buddha. But there is no real evidence for that. This is later legend. This is later mythology built up of the hundreds of years after the Buddha passed away, when the Buddha biographies were written down by people who couldn't really remember anymore exactly what happened. What actually happened, what you find in the suttas, in the where, what is closest to what the Buddha himself would have said, some of it probably capturing the word of the Buddha very, very closely. What does he say? And what he says, which is very fascinating, is that it was death in particular that was the driving force for the Buddha to be, to set out on his quest. This was the thing, more than anything else. It lists their old age, it lists illness, but it also lists death. And death is the most powerful of these three things. Why? Because it kind of brings together illness and old age within itself. Yeah, death is like the umbrella term for all of these things. And later on in the Buddha's teachings, he talks about death much more than he talks about old age or illness. So death is like the most powerful thing here. So you read a sutta like this, called the Sukkumala Sutta, in the Anguttara 3s, where the Buddha talks about how he was brought up in comfort and he had all of these wonderful things. He had three houses, he had the best food, the best clothes, he had cloth from Benares. I don't have cloth from Benares. Actually, good point. Maybe monks shouldn't have cloth from Benares. We should probably have cloth from, where from? This is Thai, actually. This is also very nice cloth, but it's not cloth from Benares. At that time in India, anyone who was anybody, they had cloth from Benares. Benares cloth was the best. And he had the best kind of food. He had three houses. He had someone carrying a parasol over him wherever he walked, so he kind of dust couldn't settle on him, that kind of stuff. And he had a band of musicians looking after him, all female musicians according to the sutta, etc., etc. So he had all the kind of pleasures of the ordinary life. And then he saw death. Then he realized the problem of death. It's not like he saw a dead man. That's also mythology. He just realized that death is a problem. That was the big moment. And based on that, at that moment when he saw death, he understood it. I've got to do something here. And this is explained even further, in even greater detail, in the Arya Pariyesana Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya number 26, Sutta on the Noble Search, which is the Buddha's search for awakening, for freedom from the suffering and the deaths and all the problems in the world. And in the Arya Parayasana Sutta, the Buddha says, I reflected to myself, I myself am mortal, I'm going to die. And yet, despite the fact that I am mortal, I go out into the world and seek other things that are also mortal. What are those things? A wife, children, animals, yeah, like horses and cattle. These were the things, the markers of wealth at that time. Or things that are impermanent and therefore also immortal, like money, wealth and possessions. Why do I, if I am mortal myself, seek other things that are also mortal? And the Buddha thinks, instead of doing that, because I am mortal, I should seek things that are free from mortality, free from death. That is the only reasonable thing to do. He understands that if you go out into the world and you attach to things that are impermanent, attach to things that are subject to death, then of course you're going to have to grieve down the track. You're going to have to bear the problems of holding on to things that are going to disappear. It is difficult enough to die for yourself. It's hard enough to die on one's own, let alone if you attach to all of these other things in the world at the same time. And for the Buddha, this was such a powerful insight. Yeah, and this says something about the death contemplation, how powerful it is. This was the thing that made the Buddha go forth. To seek the deathless. Deathless just means the freedom from death. That's really all it means. It doesn't mean some state. It means the freedom from death in the world, because it is so inherently problematic. It's a wonderful opportunity now, you know, in the middle of the COVID situation and climate catastrophe and all of these things, to remember this, because it is so close to us. It's actually easier for us to understand where the Buddha was coming from, or where the Buddha to be was coming from. And then the Buddha goes forth based on that. And of course, he does find a solution. So Buddhism, yeah, this whole religion, this whole teaching of Buddhism, this is going on for 2,500 years, is based on the fact that one person contemplated death to a very deep level. That's what it's based on. That is how powerful death contemplation is. It brought the Buddha into existence. Isn't that kind of astonishing? It's not about compassion for all humanity. That came afterwards. Of course, once he has found the solution, then the compassion for humanity arises. But it can't arise first, because he didn't even know if there was a solution yet. He didn't know if there was a way out. So first he finds the solution. Once the solution is found, that is where compassion for humanity finds its right place. Not beforehand. But this is how powerful it is. So it shows us that we also should make more of this death contemplation in our life, because it has a very powerful spiritual impact. It gives us a sense of priorities, of what really matters in life. And that is what it did to the Buddha to be, in a very, very powerful way. So it is something that we really need to cultivate. And so the Buddha goes forth. He leaves everything behind, all of these mortal things, all of these problems in the world. He leaves that behind. He goes forth. And one of the first things that he does when he goes forth, he becomes a monk. He seeks out the existing teachers in India at the time. He was quite a humble man. He wasn't just going out there saying, yeah, I'm going to solve this on my own, I don't need anyone else. No, he was wise enough to take the teachings of existing teachers at that time, even though he was very special. So he goes to these two famous teachers you find in the sutta, that's called Alara Kalama and Uddaka Ramaputta. Two famous teachers at that time in India, and they occur in a few places in the suttas. So he goes to them, and then they say, well, we have this system of meditation. And if you practice the system of meditation, first you go through the Alara Kalama, you can reach the plane of nothingness. Yeah? So the Buddha follows the teaching, he practices accordingly, and he reaches the plane of nothingness. Now this is like one of the highest kind of attainments you can possibly have in samadhi. Yeah, if you really want to live eternally, this is probably where you want to hang out. Yeah, a plane of nothingness. One of the most kind of refined possible experiences you can have anywhere in samsara. But the Buddha said, or the Buddha to be, he said, he looked at it and said, well, this only leads to rebirth in that plane. And because it only it is to rebirth in that plane, it is not satisfactory. So he said to Lara Kalama, okay, enough. Yeah, Lara Kalama said, oh, please become the leader. Yeah, you are so wonderful. Become the leader of our group. And no, he said, come, no, become teacher with me. So we are together teachers in this group. And the Buddha said, enough. No, this is not what I'm looking for. And then he leaves. And that is a very, very powerful moment, because it shows you that this man who was to become the Buddha had some very profound wisdom, where most people would attach to a very powerful and subtle experience that was like the meaning, that really felt, it feels like you find the meaning of life when you touch these things, because they are so powerful. This is it. I found the meaning of life. If you really think you found out the meaning of life, you're not going to go any further, because the meaning has been found. That's by definition all you want to do. So that's what most people would think. But the Buddha-to-be was too sharp to actually accept that. He realized, because this state of nothingness has been created through his meditation practice, through causes, through conditions, it will be temporary. It cannot last forever. It will only last a certain amount of time, because that is the nature of anything that has been created and caused by conditions. It will only last so long. So he went against the stream. These were the Brahmanical teachers of the time who believed in eternalism, the eternalism of the mind and all these kind of things. And then he rejected these things. He rejected eternalism. Before, he had seen the danger of death. Now he had seen given up the idea of eternalism. Yeah, this was the second step that the Buddha did. You can see how it parallels the things I was talking about before in our society. How on the one hand we want to escape death, but on the other hand we should not try to find the solution in eternalism, because eternalism doesn't work. And this is what the Buddha found out through his own search. Yeah. And he also knew that there was a rebirth. He knew that this would just carry on into a new life. And that insight into rebirth becomes even stronger later on when he recalls his past life. So he also doesn't believe in annihilationism, the ending of things when you die. He knows that it carries on. So it's like, it feels like you are trapped, yeah? It carries on through rebirth. On the other hand, eternalism is impossible. So what does that mean? Does it mean you are stuck in death? Does it mean that we have to carry on, or is there a solution? And this is, of course, where the insight of the Buddha goes to the most profound level. He gives this up. He recalls his past lives. And then, of course, he makes that breakthrough where he understands dependent origination, and then understanding the cessation of things. There is no annihilation. There is no eternalism to be given up. What there is instead is an understanding of the suffering of the world, the suffering in your life. And once you see that, you cannot give up that desire to be reborn. And when you give it up, things just peter out and they cease at the end of the day. That is what the Buddha saw on his night of awakening. Very parallel to the things, how we seek for the end of death in the present day, except he went much, much further and found it in the right way. So, what does that mean? What does all of this mean in practical terms for us day-to-day life? Well, what it means, of course, is first of all just to understand these things so you can actually appreciate what the Buddha taught and why it is different from the ordinary ways of thinking about the world. But how can we use this in a more kind of day-to-day basis so it helps us in our practice? And one of the most important things with the idea of death is that it reprioritizes your life. It makes it so clear what really matters. We tend to live too much in this world, too much attached to the things that happen in this life. This life, for most people, is all there is and all that actually is important. But once you understand the idea of death, that everything has to go, you start to understand the value of the spiritual life. You start to understand why it is that we cultivate the mind, why it is that we are not so concerned about things in this life. Or if we are concerned about things in this life, it is to live well so that we can both do good things for this world and also cultivate the mind at the same time. And this is one of the most valuable things. And it also works for meditation practice, yeah? If you are able to imagine yourself on your deathbed in meditation, as I was suggesting before during the guided meditation, if on your deathbed you are giving up the world, in meditation we also want to give up the world. So by doing this during meditation, it actually encourages the mind to lean in the right direction towards giving things up. Death meditation or death contemplation is very, very powerful. And I would really recommend you to do it. Now is a wonderful opportunity, because now we have the COVID-19 situation around the world. Lots of people are dying from it. We have so many problems in the world. It's a wonderful opportunity to remember the shortcomings of human existence. An opportunity to go move your mind in a different direction. Move towards those things that really matter. Find a refuge in the right place. Don't find a refuge in the world. The world can never be a safe place for anyone. So this is, if you use death in this way to understand what really matters, it will become a massive benefit for you in your spiritual life. It will propel you forward, and it will make you and all the people who rely on you much happier as a consequence. And then when death eventually comes, you will be far, far better prepared when you eventually have to face it. Okay, so that is a little talk about death, dying, eternal life, and that kind of thing. So, that's it. Okay, very good. Very good. Okay, thank you, Dennis. Dennis is the sadhu man today. So, now we'll take a few questions. Thank you very much. Okay, so we have the following questions. From the first one is from Sweden. Sweden is my ex-neighbor country, so hello Sweden. As you may know, I'm Norwegian, so we have a lot in common. One thing we have in common is a long border. That's one of the things we have in common. There are probably other things as well. So your question is, dear Ajahn Brahmali, does fear of death disappear only for an awakened one? And fear of death gradually decreases as you develop your mind. One of the reasons why we fear death is because of the uncertainty on the other side. We just don't know what's going to happen. But it's as if, as you develop your mind, it's as if that uncertainty diminishes. I don't know if you have noticed this, but I have certainly noticed in my own life that when I feel really good about myself, really happy, really together, you have a good feeling about everyone around you, you don't fear death anymore. You feel, it's almost like you feel immortal in a way. Of course, you're not immortal, but it's just that death doesn't matter. So because death doesn't matter, that's a kind of immortality in inverted commas. Yeah, because death doesn't matter. So it's a bit like that. So because you feel good about yourself, and the more you have of the Brahma Viharas, of loving kindness and all the good qualities in your mind, the less you fear death. It's as if death can't touch you anymore, yeah? Because you have all the happiness within. And because death can't touch you, why on earth would you be fearful of death? So, no, it is not just for the awakened ones. It is for anyone who practices this path. The deeper you take it, especially the Brahma Viharas, the less fearful of death you are going to be. Of course, if you become fully awakened, if you become a stream mentor, then these things will diminish to zero and they will never come back again. But you don't have to go that far. So keep on practicing the path. And every step of the path is going to be a step in the right direction here. Okay, question from Malaysia. Is Nibbana permanent? Is it too not eternal? Is Nibbana eternal? Ding, 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 ding. Is it eternal? So what does Nibbana mean? And here you have to understand the meaning of this word, yeah? Eternal, only something can be eternal. But remember, the meaning of Nibbana, the literal meaning, is extinguishment. So if you extinguish a flame, is that extinguishment eternal? Well, the extinguishing is eternal, but there's nothing left there to last forever. It's just that you have extinguished something. Nibbana means extinguishment. Yeah. So you are ending. What are you ending? You're ending suffering. So yes, suffering has ended for eternity, but that doesn't sound so bad. If suffering has ended for eternity, how can you possibly not delight in that. That sounds pretty good, doesn't it? And that's really all it means. Suffering has gone for eternity. Something has been extinguished. Pain has been extinguished. Problems have been extinguished. Defilements have been extinguished. Everything that is bad in the world is gone. It is purely a matter of extinguishment. So is Nibbana eternal? Well, to the extent that you have extinguished suffering, to that extent it is eternal. That's a very different kind of eternity than the eternal heaven or the eternal realm. It's a very different conception of eternal, and that's, you have to be very clear here about the differences between these things. Okay, then we have a question from Unknown. Is that your name? That would be a cool name, to have a name and to be called Unknown, wouldn't it? That would be a really nice name. That's probably a very honest name. You know, who are we? We don't really know who we are. We kind of wander around and we do random stuff through our life, and then suddenly you die and, okay, Unknown. Okay, that's your name. Okay, you call you Unknown. But anyway, hello Unknown, wherever you are. I don't think that's your name, because I see there's no, if it was a capital U, then it would be a name, but it's not a capital, just lowercase U. So it must be just an unknown person. So your question is, anyway, is the pandemic a chance for us to pause and see how we have been rushing towards our human extinction? The rate of damage to all things natural has accelerated in the last 20 years. Yes, I think that is certainly very useful way of thinking about it, to stop up a little bit and ask ourselves whether we really are living in a good way, whether we are living in a way that kind of nurtures life and enables us to survive and live for the long term, and to have more arahats and more noble ones and more meditators and more wise people in the world. Yeah, this is what really matters perhaps at the end of the day. Are we living in the way whereby we get more arahats, or are we living in a way where we get less arahats or aryas or wise people anyway? I think it's a very good point. This is a chance. If you use the coronavirus situation properly, it is certainly a chance to reflect and to think. And one of the things that you realize very quickly, when you look at the coronavirus situation, one of the things that I have seen is how much goodness comes out of people in these difficult times. How people seem to care more for each other, how people seem to do kind things that they haven't done before. I see this in the monastery big time. Lots of people coming to the monastery. And our monastery is about, I don't know where you live, maybe you live far away, but our monastery is about 1 hour's drive from Perth. People drive 1 hour to our monastery. They drop off food. Ajahn Brahm gives them a quick blessing, and then they go off again. No chance to sit down. No chance to talk to their friends. No chance to ask Ajahn Brahm any questions. Don't even have a chance to hear any jokes from Ajahn Brahm. That's real dukkha. One of the reasons people come to the Bodhinanda Monastery is to hear Ajahn Brahm tell a few jokes and just to mess around and have a joyful time. I think one of the nice things about Bodhinanda Monastery, it's a light-hearted place where you can just relax and be at ease and nothing is too serious. And that's one of the reasons why Ajahn Brahm loves to just joke and mess around, because he's a salesman of happiness. And that salesmanship of happiness comes out through the light-heartedness of his personality. But it's marvelous to see people do that. Coming all that way, being so generous, and seeing people caring for each other in a new way. It is marvelous to see the good qualities come out of people. I gave another talk quite recently over the internet. All the talks I give these days are over the internet. That was from the monastery. And I mentioned a book that I read about 30 years ago, or maybe, around 30 years ago. I'm getting really old now, kind of starting to fall apart radically, which is, I don't know, it means less and less to me whether I'm getting old or not. It's okay to be old, actually, not a bad thing at all. You start to feel a bit wiser than you were before. So if you can increase wisdom, even though the body is falling apart, then it must be a good thing here. But this book I read 30 years ago was called something like Human Happiness. It was basically about what makes human beings happy. And this book was written in 1945, immediately after the Second World War. You can imagine, why does anyone write about human happiness immediately after the Second World War? How many people died in the Second World War? It was almost 100 million people who died during the Second World War. It was one of the most destructive acts of human warfare in human history. So, you know, billions of dollars or trillions of dollars of buildings and material goods razed to the ground. Lots of people died, people grieving for the dead ones, all of these things. And yet, here comes this fellow and writes a book about human happiness. And what he said, and this was what was so interesting about this, and this was very, what really caught my eye at the time, because I was always been a bit obsessed about death and happiness and these kind of things. That's probably why I ended up as a Buddhist monk, because it's kind of straight down my line from I was quite young in many ways. And he said that the paradox of happiness was that during the Second World War, when all of these bad things were going on, people were more happy than they were before the war. Yeah, why was that? And he said the reason was because during the Second World War, there was a strong sense of sisterhood and brotherhood. People coming together, people working together. They all had a sense of common purpose. Everyone needed support. They cared more for each other because the external enemy was so obvious. It was Nazism or whatever. Yeah, and so they all felt that they were working together towards some common purpose and reason. It didn't mean that they were working together to kill others. Sometimes they just worked together to survive. Yeah, and that sense of working together, of caring, of doing the right thing for once, instead of just mindlessly pursuing sensual pleasures, which is probably what they did, especially in the roaring 20s, yeah, the Great Gatsby and all of that. Instead of doing that, which is often so, makes you feel empty inside, it's so pointless, they started to come from the heart instead. They came from good qualities inside, and that was what made life far richer, far more purposeful than it had been before the war. Isn't that kind of astonishing? Here you have said one of the biggest disasters in human history. So many people dying. All the external world was in a complete mess. And yes, in the hearts, people felt more happy than before. And the paradox of happiness, and what that shows you, is that what really matters for happiness in this world is our inner qualities. What we build up inside, that is at the end of the day what really matters. The external world can only give us a little bit of happiness. Our inner qualities are what really matters. And yet, how much time, how much resources do we spend on the external world? That's all that seems to matter. If you hear the politicians speak about, you know, the economy, it's always about whether the economy is growing or not, even though at the end of the day, the size of the economy is probably not all that relevant to our happiness. That's what this was saying. Yeah. So the COVID situation, you're right. It's a chance to change our values. It's a chance to recalibrate. It's a chance to understand again, remind ourselves of the nature of existence. Nature of existence is inherently problematic. We need to turn to a different place. We need to turn inward. That is where real happiness is to be found. This is just right view on the Buddhist path. Right view on the Buddhist path, the first noble truth is that there is suffering. Illness is suffering. Yeah, COVID-19 is suffering. Actually, it doesn't say that in the first noble truth, but it's kind of included there. Yeah, under illness is suffering, so it's kind of there anyway. Death is suffering. It's all there in the Buddhist teachings, and we just tend to forget it. Now is a chance to be reminded. Now is a chance to bring that right view back out again. And when we remember that, it makes us more caring. It makes us better human beings. And we start to live in a different way. So what you are saying is right, but I would expand it out to bring in the whole right view of Buddhism to make us change the way we think about things, being less greedy, being less angry, being more caring, more generous, more wise as human beings. Okay, so thank you very much. And that is all for tonight. I wish you all well, and may you have a happy Vaisak with Ajahn Brahm on Sunday. Actually, we're supposed to end off by bowing to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Let's do that first of all, and just do the chanting at the very end.
Sasipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sangha.